Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Dave Weiner here, and are you there? Okay.
I'm here.
Oh, good. Ooh, you had me worried there for a second. Jay, how you doing? Interesting
I'm
week,
great.
Huh?
Is this Dave Weiner of Scripting News?
It is. Do you think it would be a different Dave Weiner this week than like the last 13 weeks? No, I got a different Dave over here now.
Well, we're ready for rebooting the news number 14, and the world is cooperating with us by granting us all kinds of events to discuss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not the least of which, I'd like to start. Let's start with the Frumkin story at the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, and this is kind of a new story for me, I hadn't really heard much about it. He was a blogger at the Washington Post, and he was fired last week.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to start there and tell us what happened?
Dan Frumkin was a writer for WashingtonPost.com, the web operation of the Post, and he's the author of an extremely popular column called White House Watch that was very blog-like in that he started his day by capturing all the coverage of the White House, reading what all the newspapers and professional journalists wrote and also what the bloggers wrote, and piecing together the best of it, but also taking the opportunity to comment on things that were in the coverage and lots of things that were getting passed over and missed. And from his perch, partly in the blogosphere, partly on the web, but definitely within the Washington Post, he began to attract quite a following. And he was a contract writer as opposed to a staff person at the newspaper. And when his contract came up for renewal, they decided not to renew him. And Frumkin was not only an extremely effective journalist in reporting on the White House and challenging the master narrative that the rest of the press was putting out, but he was an important liaison between the Washington Post organization and the political blogosphere, because he was constantly being talked about and linked to, and he had many readers in the blogosphere, and he represented a kind of future journalism which the Post is actually now very much in the middle of. It's hired Ezra Klein as a blogger. Greg Sargent was hired from Talking Points Memo to the Washington Post. But Frumkin was there first, and he was one of the first editors of WashingtonPost.com. He was somebody who immersed himself in the web early, before most people really knew it was important. And so to sever your relationship with somebody like that is just a very striking thing, like a weird, anomalous, bizarre thing. But that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Who made that decision? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, it probably was a decision of the editor in the opinion section that was proposed and approved by Fred Hyatt, who's the editorial page editor of Washington Post.
So they still, I mean, a lot of what you said was basically that it was a bad business decision to let Frumkin go, right? I mean, from an editorial standpoint, obviously, seems like it was pretty strange decision.
It was both.
But
it was a strange decision editorially.
It was a
bad business decision, and it was a bad organizational move, because somebody who has knowledge that the rest of your people need is to let go.
Yeah. It's funny how that kind of stuff happens in the tech business all the time, you know. I mean, it's I think that there may be a back story to this, some dispute. I mean, I'm just saying, in my world, when this happens, it's usually because people didn't get along at a personal level. And
yeah,
it was sort
sure.
of like me or him sort of thing. And somehow the person who stayed had more juice than the person who was pushed out.
Well, there's always a triggering event, and that's one meaning of cause. But then there's
mm-hmm.
always a bigger story, which is, okay, there was a dispute, the person's obnoxious, he did this, he did that, But if the organization thought what they were doing was super important, none of that would matter. And
yeah.
There's always both stories at once, and that's certainly the case here. It's maybe Frumkin, you know, maybe Frumkin did this or did that or had a conflict with this person or that. I have no idea. But
I think this is an instance of your Church of the Savvy sort of correcting. You know, they sort of got off their savvy, basically, at the Washington Post, and it feels to me like they're trying to get back onto their savvy, relocate it, and reconnect with it, which, of course, today seems like the wrong thing to do. So it's sort of like there are a bunch of different threads. You know, one thread is, you know, what's good journalism, right? And so in this case, and I listened to your interview on Salon.com with Greenwald.
Greenwald, yes, thank you.
Yeah, and so I have all that as background as well, and that he was more sort of a correcting force in terms of taking us into the rebooted news world, and there's still probably some hope over there that the old savvy world is going to reemerge, and I mean, the world in which, as you pointed out, that at the time Frumkin was rising, there was this consensus that you couldn't stop the conservatives and, you know, even though we all sort of secretly knew that the war in Iraq was a terrible mistake, we all sort of pretended that it wasn't a terrible mistake, or they did. I mean, I can speak for myself. I always more or less said what I thought about it. But
well,
Frumkin probably... Go ahead, sorry.
Well, in the background to the disputes between him and others at the Washington Post, there's this larger and really dramatic story of how you establish authority in political journalism these days. And part of the conflict here was that Frumkin was doing something professional journalists associate with the blogosphere, in that he was practicing a kind of derivative art, in that it required him first to absorb all the coverage. But he didn't stop with that. He wasn't just a media critic. He would then look at what the Bush White House was doing,
right,
look at the coverage, remember what he wrote 3 months ago, and say, wait a minute, that whole issue just disappeared. Or wait a minute, he just lied. Or wait a minute, they just totally contradicted himself. And by not following the daily news, he was not wedded to the daily spin, right? And so what the Post reporters were saying is, yeah, he's saying that, but that's because he's a liberal columnist.
Right.
And he's got his take, you see? But it wasn't a case of somebody's opinionated take. It was a case of now we can compare the coverage to what we know happened, and the coverage has got to catch up to where the web is. That's what he was saying. And they didn't want to hear that. They didn't want their authority challenged in that way. And eventually, by classifying him as opinion and then finding him expendable, they got rid of him.
Well, so
the Church of the Savvy
excommunicated
somebody, yeah.
Well, you know, it's the church that, you know, it's funny. You said something I read on a post, I think it was on Friend Feed today. I forget the exact words you used. You were quoting me saying, well, we're already using the rebooted news system. Is that what... it's funny because what they're trying to do is regroup and... So
reboot the old system, yeah.
I know. And the contradiction is that everywhere else they're reporting that all assembling and it's not working anymore. So why rush back to it so quickly? Seems kind of crazy to want to go there that quickly.
That's why people like
back
James
there. It's
Fallow
all very, it,
shook his head.
Sorry. Yeah.
That's why people like James Fallow said shook his head.
it's a head shaker for sure. You know.
Let's move on to we're already using it. Something you said about rebooting the news, maybe number 4, number 5.
Right.
was people are arguing about whether the sources, you know, can go direct, but we're already doing it. We're already using the new system. And I kind of knew what you meant at the time, but now I really see what you mean. And that's how I felt. That line kept coming back to me this week as we watched the media try to cover events in Iran, and we saw people in Iran and people concerned about the story covering it themselves.
The alive and well.
Yeah,
doing
it's working.
It's not only doing its job, bringing about regime change, which all of the guns and all the military pressure in the world didn't do, but this new news system, all of a sudden, it's the whole world is watching. This is something Clay Shirky says didn't actually happen. I met with this week. Points out, for those who were old enough to remember at the time, that the world was indeed watching. It's not a new idea. People count. Wow. I mean, you go back to the Boston Tea Party was a good example of the whole world watching. The shot heard around the world, people with the power to change things. It's an assumption that the world always is the way people think it always will be, because it never is. Things, we only get that illusion because we feel like we live forever, and we don't, So we don't have that memory that goes back far enough. I remember the first time I ever wanted to get on the rooftop and shout that the old news system isn't working and you guys don't get it was when... that's my own revolution, okay? I'm not in Tehran, and thank God I'm not in, having to deal with concentration camps and people rounding up. My grandfather was, though, and he raised me to watch out for those things. This was a sit on my lap, here I'll tell you a story about what it looks like, and, when they come to get you, because that actually happened to him, and... it sounds a lot like the fear that the people in Iran live with. But my revolution is this one that we keep talking about. I remember Salon boasting, it was like 1995 or 96, that they were actually sending a reporter to Bosnia, and that this was sort of a milestone for the Internet. And I wrote at the time and said, no, it's not a milestone for the Internet. We already have thousands of people in Bosnia. And over time, we're going to have a lot more. So you don't get somewhere by sending somebody there. What you do is by extending your reach, your vision, your hearing to be able to actually hear what those people have to say and what's going on from their point of view. Because our view of it is always going to be limited by our own experience, and that doesn't necessarily yield anything accurate. I mean, that's one of the things that there's a tremendous temptation in viewing the news from Iran to believe that we understand that it's all relative to the United States, and to some extent, I'm sure that it is. But I'm sure that doesn't explain it well enough, and for us to really have an understanding of it. You have to be Iranian to really get what's going on there.
I want to capture something you said. I think it's really important for this ongoing series. One way of extending the new system is to get more people and send them to the story. The other way is by equipping the people who are there to be relayers and finders of news. And so by extending the news network to more people, we're building a new system for news. I know that's what you said, and that's what you were referring to with Bosnia, but it was proven and shown this week, finally, to everyone. That's what's different. It's not that it's a new concept. It's that finally everyone sees it because of the drama of events in Iran and the difficulty of getting news out any other way.
Right.
This goes back to the campaign when Mayhill Fowler got stories about Obama for off the bus that weren't being gotten or didn't get reported by the traditional press. One of the things I said at the time was, wait a minute, professional journalists, do you or do you not want to extend the news network so that it includes people in the crowd? Because when Clinton goes into the crowd, they're part of the news network, right? News network?
I don't buy that. I don't like the way you framed it, okay? Because you're doing the Church of the Savvy thing there, right? You said, do we want it to go into the crowd? Actually, what we want is we want the journalists to be of the crowd. We want We don't want them to feel separate from the crowd. That's what's changing. That's what you admire about Frumkin, was that he didn't have he didn't have to stroke the big guys in the sphere because he wasn't trying to get access to them. He was just sort of watching and observing and piecing it together the way a person who didn't have access would. And
that's right, and that was a very valuable thing. That was extremely
valuable. And
that is,
I think it's the only valuable thing. Because here's something else that I realized this week, is that the person doing the interview is actually part of the audience. Mm. He or she has some special capabilities. He's the only member of the audience that can speak at any point in time that they want to. But they are acting there as a representative, as part of the audience. And I think that's a key element of the rebooted news system, is that this identification with the people that they're covering is the mistake of the past system. It's why we get into so much trouble.
Okay, well, that wasn't what I said at all, but I agree with that point. This leads us to the new system of the future?
Okay. Right, yes. Well, actually, it does, but here's the segue, that it's not, okay, so people are realizing things that both you and I have been evangelizing for, in both of our cases, for many, many years, and
true.
It's kind of sweet and a little bit bitter at the same time, because I can't speak for you, but partly because think of all the wasted time that we could have saved had we... Had people been, that's how I look at it. I mean, there are a lot of mistakes.
I don't look at it that way, but I see what you say. I see what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm constantly there, okay? It's like, geez, we could have avoided that. Why do we have to keep doing this? And it's the loop of the tech business, and it's the loop of the political world as well. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what is the method to this process? It's the meta story is even more interesting than the specifics of the story. How do you piece together the puzzle of what the future of communication and news is going to look like based on what you already know about what's happening in the technology world? Because I think, if anything, that's the theme of this series, is that the two are inexorably linked, and it's only an illusion that at times we feel that they aren't, that there's a sense of permanence to the technology is an illusion. There is no such thing. Always evolving, it's always shifting, and it always creates new possibilities. For example, this week, I want to get this out. This week, Apple shipped a new product called the iPhone 3GS. And the 3GS, at TechCrunch, they said they misnamed it. Should have been the 3GV for video, because it is an incredibly high-quality video camera that communicates. And it communicates with an extremely simple user interface. You just set it up once, you take the video button, and boom, it goes up to YouTube. And think about the implications for that. I mean, today it's still around a little bit of a trick to get that stuff out to the internet. The next generation of these phones is simply not going to be a trick at all. So everybody that has one of these phones is going to be a broadcast station, they used to carry around on their shoulder.
Right.
It's going to be a witness for the world for everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the way it's always been. It's always been that way. If you look at journalism and the long sweep of social practice over hundreds of years, which is how I was trained to look at it, what you find is that journalism, the act of telling people what's going on in the world over their horizon, is a constant. And it weaves in and out of different technological regimes again and again, dozens and dozens of times. And it is rewoven every time. And so if you want to try and understand the journalism of the future, you have to realize how impermanent practices are as journalism moves in and out of different eras of technology. And Geneva Overholzer, who is the director of the journalism program at USC and a former editor of the Iowa newspaper Des Moines Register, as well as a New York Times person, said something really important a couple weeks ago. She said, it's the principles, not the practices, that we have to keep. And this is part of what happened to the professional press. They defended their practices as if they were principles, but that can never be true in an era of technology change.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's also true of the technology industry. It's how it builds up to these explosions, and they happen periodically. You know, you don't have to be a perceptive person to see that, that every so often, 10 years seems to be about the length of time each generation lasts. There's an explosive deconstruction of the world that was created by the last generation. And I think that what you're going to see, now the cycles I think have been longer in news. The reign of TV lasted between, what, the 60s and...
Yeah, it was a fairly stable system for a long period of time,
I think it just ended this week, by the way. I think this was the actual final straw for the last incarnation of TV news, the way we used to do it. You know, I think this was it. I couldn't watch the CNN coverage. I just found it...
I couldn't either.
It was flat. It was sterile. It was belabored. It was a response to what the net was doing. It wasn't the actual event. It wasn't, you know, in the past...
That's how it felt,
It was the total thing that you were watching was what was happening there on their stages. It simply wasn't there. The cursor wasn't there. Even though there was some good reporting, I thought that I saw Christiane Amanpour's summary of the week's event.
That was very
CNN.
Good,
Yeah, it was excellent and very useful, and I think that we should get that on YouTube, okay? So that everybody actually will see it, because I don't think anybody's really seeing it. The new system of the future, though, okay, is it's now taking shape. You can almost see it. And I think Patrick LaForge at the New York Times did a really good job of painting the picture in sort of a schematic format in his a piece where he outlines what professional journalists should know about Twitter. Patrick LaForge is a leader. I hope it doesn't embarrass him to hear him described that way. I imagine that it might. I think I said this in the last show. If I didn't, I want to say it now. I think the Times did not get enough credit for the work that they did on the Iran story. I think they did actually exactly what was needed. And the other thing is that they played in the new system of the future, which is today,
right.
The closest approximation to it is Twitter. And I don't mean that it is the new system of the future, because I don't think it can be in the form that it's in right now. But it's a really, really, really good dress rehearsal for it.
Uh-huh.
And what's being learned there now is what will totally shape the way we do news in the future. And so that's what I mean. It's like,
okay,
focus your attention on this is the rebooted news system is becoming quite specific. And now, what is it that you would change about Twitter, and what features we have to add. And now we're going to learn how to do brainstorm and how to be product designers and reporters don't know how to take that thing to the government. Well, I feel like that works.
I can't hear a word you're saying now. You're fading out. There's static on the line, and I'm lost. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me now?
No. It's that like a helicopter sound.
If anybody can watch on radio looking in, I can use the chat and ask to see if you have Jay's mind. Can you hear me now?
No, and I'm on a landline, so I don't know that it's
not you, it's me. I'm on Skype.
Definitely Skype.
Is it
I can kind of hear you now.
Okay,
now I can.
Can hear me? Okay.
Now you're back. Sorry about that.
No, why are you sorry? It's like, don't be sorry. I was at a good place to stop anyway.
All right. Well, I had a couple of responses to what you said. I got most of it. First is, for me, an amazing moment was simply when I just saw this notice on the front page of NewYorkTimes.com, which I did send out over Twitter. It was just a invitation from the NewYorkTimes.com, and it said, readers inside Iran or in touch with people there are encouraged to send information or to email photos to. Mm-hmm. And just seeing that was like a 15-year journey to that point. Because this was the biggest news story of the time when that notice was sitting there. It was the front page of the leading news source in the world. And it was sort of saying to me, at least, like a blinking light, that the Pro-Am system is already here. We're already using it. We need it because actually it's our best chance of finding out what's going on, right? And so that's, to me, that's a long march. That started with civic journalism in around 1992, right? And yet it was very satisfying to see these things. And a whole other idea that I have tried to get across in a variety of ways in my work and in doing interviews, which is that open systems don't work like closed systems. They have different benefits. They have different problems. They are just different animals. Everybody was grappling with that this week. You know, this open system, it's different. It doesn't work like a newsroom, you know? and it, in some ways, it doesn't work at all. And we have to recognize that, too. And one thing I liked in what you were saying is that it's not that Twitter is the new news system. That's a little too mechanical. It's that you have to use Twitter to get an image of what the new system will look like, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the closest thing to this networked world where we expand the news by bringing more tools to the people who are already at the news. And that, I think, is definitely a theme that we've developed, and I picked it up, so even though I faded out, I got the most important part.
Mm-hmm. It's the dress rehearsal, is what I was saying.
It's the dress rehearsal. Yeah. It's the metaphor. It's an image we can use to conjure up a better. Now, tons of problems flood.
Right. Well, that's what I. That's
when
what
you realize, you know, that you have an open system.
Well, I think my punchline did not make it through. Which is now the question is, what rules would you like to relax, and what features would you like to add, and to suspend your critical voice. In other words, let people say what they have to say. There's an awful lot of judgment in this. Like I say, I don't like the 140-character limit. I say that because there are times when I absolutely hate it. I mean, it means that there are things that cannot be communicated, and that to me is a fatal flaw. Right? If there's a piece of, I'm sorry, Jay, the people, it really is.
I'll tell you my fatal flaw. Can't edit it. Send out mistakes.
Okay.
I hate that. I just hate that as a writer. I completely hate
great.
It.
Great. Okay, this is what we need, all right? We need your list, and we need the list of all the people who love news. Listen, it's the people who love news, who understand news, care about it, and are actually in this environment. We need their list. That's the... that's how you do it from my side of it is, you know, I remember this is a classic. I was having a party at the Hotel St. Francis on Union Square in like 1986. Guy Kawasaki comes up to me and he says, the new president of Apple products, Jean-Louis Gasset, would like me to hand you this list. So he handed me this list, and I took a look at it. It was a list of feature requests for my product.
Feature requests. I like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I thought, wow, this guy not only understands products, but he understands how I tick and what makes me go. Because and he got all that just simply by using my product, because we had never met. And when I looked at the list, Jay, I knew that this guy was a serious user of my product, because – I was a sponge for these lists. I lived off of them. And then it gave me a profile of what my users were like and what they wanted, the most passionate people. And I could tell that this guy, Gasset, was no flake. He was a serious user of the product. Now, the thing about Twitter is, for some reason, people are not publishing those lists. There's been this hype that somehow Twitter has this magically perfect feature set. Well, there's no such thing as a piece of software that has a magically perfect feature set. And I don't believe the 140 character limit.
I don't think that at all. I think that's ridiculous.
Exactly.
Go on.
And now you just have to be given the courage to actually be feel free to actually publish those lists.
Okay, now let me extend your point. I like this idea. It would be interesting if journalists picked up this habit of feature requests, you know.
Yeah.
Said, what would you like your news system to have? What features, you know? And some spirit of that would help.
Jay,
and
in
also,
some sense, I've been knocking on that door for my entire life.
All right, well, welcome to the club.
There's nobody home. Or there hasn't been. Sorry.
Doing concept work can be a 15-year march. You have to accept that sometimes.
Absolutely.
the other thing is, what CNN was the most passionate users telling CNN that you aren't even close to the people who love news, right? Trying to alert them that there was a bug. There's a bug in your coverage. You actually should be obsessed with this story, and you're not.
Jay, when it gets to that point, I think it's over. It's like a woman saying to her soon-to-be ex-husband, you need to go long enough. You know, I think that they're starting to scream from the top of the roofs, you fail, you fail. I don't think they're coming back. Okay, I don't think that's saying, if only you would just do this. Mm. It's not like that. Those are not feature requests. Those are bullets in the middle of the head. It's not coming back. You want the love letters, not the epitaphs.
No, I was more that it was the passionate users who were alerting them.
That's correct. Yeah. You want to tap that passion before it becomes the failure.
Before it becomes rage at your failures,
That's right. I've had that too. I mean, I've had users rebel, and it wasn't just about me, it was about the whole industry. We had this practice called copy protection in the mid-80s, and led by Lotus. Lotus 1-2-3 was the first really big product that was copy protected, and so everybody did. And 2 years later, back floppy disks, which was the medium of distribution in those days, that had been cut into pieces from users. And believe me, there's nothing worse for a CEO of a software company to get that back. That's not a message you want to be hearing from your users. That's a fail. That was like, we are fed up with you. I don't want this disk. I think Twitter, if they were really listening, if they were really paying attention, they would get that. It's, now is a really good time to be listening. Because it isn't at that point yet. But
well, people should make their lists anyways. Like you said, blog them. Put them on your blog. Put them on your own Twitter feed.
Right. And it's like, and if they are like it was with Gasset in 1986 or 7 or whatever it was, there will be some things that rise to the top of that list that you know that not product. Mm-hmm. That will define a product that has magic that Twitter had 2.5 years ago when it launched that allowed it to get to the level that it's at right now. There probably will be 4 or 5 features like that. And I'm most interested in what the guys like Patrick LaForge have to say. Because, and I mean that seriously, the guys like him. I mean, I'm certainly interested in what he has to say, but people who really have an appreciation for news and practice it as a profession, who are actually living and working in this new system now, where they see the limits and where they see the opportunities, that's especially important. Right
now. Absolutely. I mean, those people and their experiences and what they're learning and picking up is gold, absolute gold.
But they haven't gotten the message yet that this is something that's allowed even, or even expected of them, that they should have this.
In my experience,
it'll come eventually, though. That will happen eventually.
In my experience, when you take good professional journalists and you hook them up to an experience, they will figure it out themselves. And so it's really getting them to try stuff that's the hurdle.
Mm-hmm. We got that. We're there.
Live blogging and RSS.
Mm, yes. Well,
came
that was
up
another
this
thing.
Week, right?
Yeah. Yep, it sure did. I mean, there were... I was watching Andrew Sullivan. I was watching the New York Times.
Oh, Andrew Sullivan. Fascinating,
Their lead blog, LEDE blog. The Guardian had an excellent blog from the European point of view. Mm-hmm. First of all, you were saying before about how great it was that people were singing the same song you've been singing. Think about it from my point of view, is that now all these great publications, I'm working on a new aggregator, and as I'm looking at all the feeds from the New York Times, about 3/4 of them are blogs. Mm-hmm. So do you think we've had some influence? I think so. I felt at that moment when I realized how thoroughly our philosophy has made it into their world. So now the next thing is, there are still some things that they haven't done yet that they ought to do. And so if you looked at the New York Times, the live blog that they had of the events in Iran, it was extremely good, but there was no feed for it. The feed was at they had a feed, but the feed was more like it had one item in it for the whole day.
Right.
What I really want is I want it broken down into the atoms, the atomic units. This is what you're like to talk about. I want it to be blown into the little bits, that so when they post a new item to it, I want that to be a separate item in the feed, so that then I can combine the flows as a user. I can combine the flows from Andrew Sullivan, from The Guardian, from this, all into one. And then, of course, now as I only have one page to go to, I can bring 50 more into it. And so I can see an event actually roll through this world from all these different points of view. I can construct my own river of news out of their rivers. Because, of course, that's really what they're doing. Those are, each one of those are rivers. And it's a wonderful format. It really works great. But that's one little tweak. And I wanted to see if there was some way to get that into their queue of things to do. It's not for the authors to do, but it's for their technical guys.
Right. It's really part of the art of seeing a feed as an editorial product that has to be good.
Absolutely. There's no question that a feed is an editorial product, and it's just a matter of quality. Absolutely.
But what I'm saying is, if you're a blog author and you're putting together a very good updated blog called The Lead, right, and you're putting all this effort into keeping it current, sifting, updating, right, you need the feed to be the product.
That's going a little bit too far to say that it's the product. It's certainly an important part of the product. Some people come to this website, and that's where they want to get it. And you never want to cut that out. That's important.
No, I'm not saying cut it out. I'm saying they're both they are both the product.
Right. And I'm just arguing with the little nitpick. It's not the product. It's an important part of. Well, because when people hear that, they're going to think, these guys are off the wall. They don't get. They've lost their sense of perspective.
But I never make extreme statements like never or cut out or stop or whatever. I'm always a both.
You do sometimes, actually. when it comes to David Gregory, I've noticed.
All right. That's true.
And I like that. I like that. I want more of that. But I understand. I think I'm beginning to understand why it is that way. So.
David Gregory on the Iraq War and the Press is a denialist. That's how what I think.
Talk about that. I love David Gregory was a very bad idea, in my opinion.
He was a terrible idea. Well, he believes that the press's performance in the run-up to the Iraq War was very good, that all the important questions were asked, and that criticism of the press for not finding stuff out is completely unwarranted. And it's a remarkable view. It's especially considering that no television network at all, to my knowledge, has even tried to conduct an investigation of what it reported and versus what the truth was and how it was used or manipulated or what fall downs occurred. As far as I know, there hasn't been anything like that. So it's an amazing statement, and it's amazing that somebody with a view like that has the position he has, in my opinion.
It is amazing. I remember watching the Iraq war coverage. I was in Cambridge. I remember exactly where I was when, it was seen as the victory. We marched into Baghdad victorious. And the network, the very network that he works for, ran a picture, a full-screen picture of George W. Bush. And underneath it said visionary. And this is what he was talking about in terms of balanced coverage of the war in Iraq. I felt like I lived in a police state.
The important questions were asked. That's what he said. We asked the necessary questions.
And we determined that the man was a visionary. Well, that was really useful journalism right there, I got to say.
We have five minutes left.
Yeah, I know. So what should we use the five? I was going to say Aaron Brown would have been my choice for.
Yeah, I liked
yeah.
him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was always a fan of his.
Thoughtful, introspective. You never knew what he was going to ask about, which is what I liked.
Yeah.
And I thought he was a good representative of the audience. That, to me, is what makes a viewer, that they are part of the audience. Not only mm-hmm. there was a lot of empathy there with Brown, I thought he really understood, at least he understood what I cared about. So, what's the last topic? Oh, inspiration.
Inspiration
of... Oh, God, I forget so quickly. Jay, it's your week. Yep.
And my inspirational source of the week is a movie from the 1970s. Many of the people who were born around the time we were, the movies that had a formative influence on their imaginations often come from the 1970s, which was a great era in American film. And for me, one of those moments is a very well-known one in the movie Network from 1976. And I've talked about it before in other presentations, but I wanted to put it on the record in this series because it's part of where I come from. It's the moment when the crazed television anchorman, Howard Beale, comes into the studio practically at the state of a mental breakdown. And he starts a kind of passionate sermon on the air to people and tells them that he's as frustrated as they are by how things are breaking down in society. And he eventually tells them he wants them to get up from their seats and go to the windows and open the window and shout out to the world, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." And in the movie, you not only watch the anchorman break the taboo of smooth professionalism and the cool style and go totally the opposite into heat. You not only see the executives at the network scurrying around trying to figure out, is this a hit or a disaster, right, while it's happening? And eventually they go to the phone and they listen to see if anyone is following his instructions. But the part that really interests me is the filmmaker Sidney Lumet cuts to people in their homes watching this. And one girl says to her father, "I'm going to go see if anyone's shouting." And you see other people curious, right? And what are they curious about? Is anyone going to show? You know, is anyone going to act if I act? And they get to their windows, and you can hear echoing around the streets of the city, other people shouting out, right? So what's so dramatic about it for me is really two things. The first is the passage those people are making is really important. They're breaking the bond with the mass media. They're going through their own locomotion to the window, and they're expressing themselves. But when they get there, what they find is kind of like an empty public sphere, right? And that scene, that is about the atomization of the mass audience, the separateness and fragmented nature, everybody in their separate homes, hooked up to big media, breaking that chain, going to the public sphere, and because so little is going on there, so few tools, they can just scream their rage into the night, right? But other people are doing it too. So when I think about social media, what we're building with Twitter and this rebooted system for news and the internet itself, the web and its magic, it starts for me with that moment, the de-atomization of the audience. And that's why I wrote a post in my blog called Audience Atomization Overcome, which is being brought about not through crazed anchorman in desperate pleas through the old mass media system, but through the very logic of our new system, which is just as good at connecting us across to other people who want to know what we want to know as it is in connecting us up to big media and crazed or cool style anchormen. So that moment is one, it repays watching, it repays study, and it's been an inspiration mm-hmm. for me in thinking about a new system for news.
Are you mad as hell?
No.
Maybe we should go out. We've got 10 seconds, Jay. Are you mad as hell and not going to take it anymore?
I'm mad as hell, and we're figuring it out.
Awesome. See you next week, Jay.
Bye.